Good afternoon, everyone. I guess this section has plenty of time, so we are not in a rush to get started, just thinking that people may be eating lunch slower coming. So anyhow, maybe it's about time to let the introduction get started. Well, I'm Henry Lim. I'm going to preside over this Brady lecture. I'm certainly glad to see you here. Thanks for coming. Before we get started introducing our distinguished speaker, Dr. Ray Weil from University of Maryland would like to say a few words about how this Brady lectureship came about on behalf of Niall Brady.
As welcome to what I think is the fourth Niall Brady Frontiers of Soil Science lecture. For those of you that don't know, I've been good friends with Niall for just a small fraction of his life. For about the last 20 years, we've written the Nature and Properties of Soils together and have roomed together at these meetings every year, except this one. Niall is not here today with us. It's not because of his health. He's in good health. But this is the first Soil Science Society of America meeting that he has missed since 1952, he tells me. And it was with great regret that he missed it, but his house in Arizona, where he lives with his wife Martha, was damaged by an undetected plumbing leak that went undetected for several weeks. You can imagine what that does to the walls, the carpets, the knickknacks, and your the soil may very well have expanded a bit under the house too, I'm not sure. But I know that Martha's nerves were too frayed for him to leave her alone with the situation of recovering from that. So he felt he had to stay with her. So I welcome you all to our lecture, in which we try to bring people who are at the forefront of soil science, who can bring a broad perspective to new areas. And today we have one of the great leaders of soil science, although I see he is now emeritus, Johann Boma. Do you want to introduce him a little bit more?
Thanks. Well, it's certainly my great pleasure and privilege to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Johann Boma, for this Brady distinguished lecture. I'm thinking that probably Johann is no stranger to almost everyone, if not. At least heard his name from his extensive publications, but he's certainly well known in our community. Johann actually has a very impressive career throughout his dedicated services and contributions to soil science and beyond, actually, even after he retired a few years back. Right now, he's a professor emeritus of soil science from Wageningen University. But prior to that, he started off his career with degrees in soil science from Wageningen University, and then a brief postdoc work at the University of Wisconsin in Madison with Francis Ho, I believe, another very well-regarded pathologist. And then Johann stayed on in Madison as a professor there and received his tenure actually just a few years there. But then he, for some reason I'm not completely clear, he decided to move back to his home country in the Netherlands. So he became a head of the Department of Soil Physics in Netherlands Soil Survey Institute from 75 to 83. Just 2 years after he got tenure as an associate professor in soil science department in Madison. And then he apparently continued his very influential work in both soil physics, pathology, and soil science in general. So he became the deputy director of Netherlands Soil Survey Institute in charge of research for several years. And then he took the position as the professor of soil inventorization and land evaluation at Wageningen University from 86 to 2002. And then he took a very challenging but very impressive job with the Scientific Council for Government Policies in the Prime Minister's Office in The Hague from 1998 to 2003. He was a member of that scientific council, and it's basically a think tank for the prime minister's office. And after that, he assumed the leadership as the scientific director for the Environmental Sciences Group of the Wageningen University and Research Center from 2001 to 2003, where he directed a total of 1,300 scientists, more or less, for all kinds of environmental research related activities. So he retired in 2003, but in my mind, he never retired. He continued very dedicated and very influential work as different kind of review panels, members and advisors, consultants for many different programs all over the world. In terms of his academic publications, he has a long list of very highly cited papers. So that's the quality part. It's hard to use number to describe that. But he has a total of over 400 papers in his career. And of that, over 260 were in peer-reviewed international top-notch scientific journals. He also contributed many chapters to a total of 28 books and was also editor and co-editor of 10 of those books. He was also editor-in-chief for Geoderma, very well-known international journal of soil science. Beyond his own scientific accomplishments, he also has far-reaching impacts on both the educating the young scientists as well as the policymakers up to this point, actually. He has supervised a total of 40 PhD students over his career in many different subject areas, ranging from water movement in structured soils, spatial variability, land evaluation, to precision agriculture, agricultural system, global change, and many different aspects, and now more publications related to policy for land use and management. He has been very influential in terms of in EU, in particularly the environmental policy in terms of the formulation and implementation. That kind of work he continues after his retirement, and so. From that brief introduction, I hope you get a sense why we had a very easy time to select Dr. Johann Baumer as this year's Brady Distinguished Lecture speaker. I am here because our committee chair couldn't make it to this meeting, so I'm on that committee, so I was asked to take care of this. But our committee, including committee chair, said that they had the easiest committee work ever, because once Johann's name nominated, boom, that's it. The committee said, let's go with it. So very efficient committee work ever, just one email, that's it. So here we are. Let's welcome our distinguished speaker, Dr. Baumer, for giving this Brady Distinguished Lecture.
Thank you very much, Henry. If this is a short introduction, I wonder what a long one is like.
I just read your page yourself.
Sorry. Dear colleagues, good afternoon. I'm very grateful for this opportunity to be able to give a presentation here this afternoon. It's quite a challenge to talk in a setting that is dedicated to Dr. Brady, one of the great pioneers of our science. So thanks for that. Now, the title, Achieving More Effective Soils Input into Sustainability Studies, a New Frontier, that is, of course, related to the general title, The Frontiers in Soil Science. And I want to start with the cover of a recent Frontiers report of the Natural Research Council, of which I assume that most of you have seen this. This is based on a workshop, a big international workshop in December 2005. It's taken a while to get it published. I was the privilege of being part of the organizing committee. And it gives, I believe, a rather good view as to what some frontiers are in terms of soil science research for the future. And of course, I will not repeat what is in this report. This is not meaningful. You can read this all by yourself. But when they asked me back home what this report is all about, there are three things that I pick out somewhat arbitrarily, I realize. Pay more attention to ecosystem services provided by soils, and try to also, as difficult as it is, to express it in terms of cost benefits. Apply a host of new techniques to characterize interacting physical, chemical, and biological processes, and establish well-equipped observatories at representative sites where you can do a lot of integrated measurements with all these new techniques, which we all know new techniques always lead to new insights and new venues for research. And also, I thought, very interesting once again, be aware of soil heterogeneity. Transformation in soil occur only in small soil pockets, so we should be aware of that. There are also some recommendations in the report that require additional scrutiny, as it is, as I believe. Consider new models for interdisciplinary collaboration. Collaborate with colleagues in social sciences, humanities, and economics to integrate advances and breakthroughs in soil science into policymaking. Translate soil science research into information for stakeholders and end users. For instance, policymakers, land developers, farmers, regulators, engineers. Teach students to collaborate across disciplines. Provide interdisciplinary opportunities and relate to the general public. This sounds familiar, right? And it's very true, but it has a little bit of quality of mother love and apple pie, as I learned this expression while I had these 6 good years in Wisconsin. Nobody would disagree with this. And I think there's a pressing question as to now, how are we really going to do it? Are we going to do it, and how are we going to do it? So that's basically, I think, the core of what I would like to talk about. We have quite a bit of time, so I would suggest that if you have questions that relate to clarity of things, that you don't understand what I'm talking about, please holler, interrupt. That's quite all right, although I think in the end it's better when the whole story is ended, if you like, to have the general discussion, okay? And I really hope we have a good discussion in the end, because I think that's a crucial element of what we're trying to do here. So, again, very true, beautiful, but what's next? Now, in Europe, but I think also in America, there's the concept of the knowledge paradox. And that is that all that research is being done somehow does not really flow through into society, somehow not really leads to real innovations. And it happens maybe to a small extent, but it doesn't happen in a way you might expect. What are the reasons? Well, lots of reasons. Rules, regulations, bureaucrats that don't work, people that don't want to take risks, you name it. All kind of things. But it doesn't happen. And that whole thing of the knowledge paradox is also a bit associated, I would think, to what in the 80s and 90s of the last century was mentioned as the knowledge economy, a kind of a feeling on the wings of the information revolution that once we get all this new information, we get a new economy that is creating new growth and all the rest of it. And that hasn't quite worked out. I attended an interesting conference in September this year at Leiden University, a fairly big conference, and the title of that was the Knowledge Democracy as being the new term. And I found that rather appealing in the sense, I don't know about America, but in Holland right now, the knowledge democracy really means that everybody has a very strong opinion about everything 24 hours a day, right? We have a program on radio every noon, Standpoint Netherlands, it's called, translated, when they raise issues. Many issues are extremely complex. Some issues are still in court, and people are asked to vote yes or no. And thousands of people use their SMS and vote. No problem. Well, I'm not standing here to say this is good or bad. I'm simply saying increasingly that's the scene in which we operate. It's the scene also in which science has to operate, and in this case, soil science has to operate. And some people feel that science has to regain its so-called societal license to research. There was a Professor Peterson from Michigan State University who gave one of the keynotes in this conference, and his point was, at a given point of discussion, the trust, the essential trust between society and science in the U.S. has gone. Now, I have no judgment on that, but I found that a rather striking statement, and I've talked with him a little bit afterwards, and he could document it as well. It's certainly true in the Netherlands also. Now, looking at this, we're not the first ones, of course, to talk about this. The key reference here, I think, in literature is the Gibbons and others' paper in 1994, The New Production of Knowledge, The Dynamics of Science and Research in Contemporary Societies, in Sage London, a lot of citations. It's one of those papers that, looking back, you say that it's really a landmark paper, because this knowledge democracy I was talking about, it's really the last decade that had really developed this way. Now, he talks about the mode one, mode two distinction, which probably is familiar to most of you, but I'll run quickly through it. Mode one of research is an academic context, it's disciplinary in character, it's in a homogeneous theater, if you like, it occurs. There's a lot of autonomy, and there's traditional quality control in terms of peer review. The mode two context of research, and I talk about research that has a societal relevance, which basically all research has, one way or the other. Not so much the academic context, but the context of application. People want to know more, what is it for? What are you trying to accomplish? Transdisciplinary. Transdisciplinary means that different scientists from different disciplines work together with stakeholders and policymakers. Interdisciplinary means that scientists of different disciplines work together. Monodisciplinarity is clear. Multidisciplinarity is that different disciplines work next to one another, right? So transdisciplinary rather than disciplinary. Heterogeneity, a lot of players involved that have opinions about everything. The knowledge democracy I was talking about. Very true, very visionary to see that already in 1994, I believe. And not a traditional quality control, but the autonomy there is the scientist was kind of autonomous. You know, he could follow his ideas and do the research that was needed. Now it's more there is social accountability. Society is asking, questioning what you're doing. Sometimes not in the right way, but that's the way it is. And there are novel quality control measures that so far have not really materialized very much, but where you don't only look at the number of papers people present, but also at the way it is effective in society, if you like. Now, this has been a very favorite area for science policy research and social sciences and all that. I've tried to dig into that a little bit the last few years, and I will not list just a few of them. And one thing that strikes you is that different authors try to define a different term for what I think essentially is the same phenomenon we're talking about. The finalization science, strategic research, post-normal science, innovation systems, academic capitalism, post-academic science, triple helix. Lots of talk. But where's the meat? Where's the real action? I may have missed it. And if I have, please inform me later. Now, so I think there's a real need, since these are many of these papers are 10 years old or older, to really say, how are we going to do it? So I repeat the question I said at the first slide, how are we going to do it? Now, let's take a step backwards and say, what are the big societal issues for the next decade or longer associated with sustainable development? Energy, food security, climate, environment, biodiversity, water. Maybe you know more, but I think six is already a good start, right? Now, talking about disciplines, and we talk here about soil science, where are the niches in each one of them? And I think it's interesting what happens right now within the societies that is the discussion of so-called grand challenges for the future. Where are the niches where soil science can make significant and unique contributions? How are we going about that? Well, the grand challenge discussion is one, huh? I realize that. But we have in Europe, at least, taken very much the line of defining the threat to the soil and then saying how we're going to cope with it. That's a legitimate procedure, but I have a problem with that. Now, let's be realistic. We are a relatively small discipline. So I repeat, what are our most productive niches in terms of what we do and how we do it? when cooperating in transdisciplinary research teams interacting with stakeholders and policymakers. These big issues, and we all know this, require interdisciplinarity and have a lot of stakeholders involved in practice, but also in the policy arena. Okay, so that's typically a mode two type of situation. How do we do that? And in any case, I think, as social scientists, we should stop whining about being left out and take a pragmatic, focused, and proactive approach based on our strengths. I go around a fair amount, and talking to social scientists, I often hear people complain. Why don't you understand us? They're so stupid. We do all these important things and all that. That's not very productive, okay? So we got to do a better thing. But the reason to raise this a little bit, too, is that I have seen many cases where very well-intentioned, in this case, social scientists, even young people, go into these broader groups where these sustainable issues are being discussed and get totally lost when they hear all the arguments of the economists and the social scientists and the politicians. They get kind of lost in the melee and don't really know what they can do and contribute. And one reflexes then, of course, to go back to one's own cubbyhole and start continue to do the basic disciplinary research, which is also good, don't get me wrong, but it's not enough for the challenge for the future. Now, transdisciplinarity, I talked about, and the mode two talks about, implies working with other disciplines and with various stakeholders and policymakers. Each one with their own jargon, very important. Sometimes you use a term and you think that you understand people, but they mean a totally different thing. And with strongly contrasting interests, how to avoid getting caught up and suffocate in broad discussions about sustainable development and how to make sure that our scientific input into the group process is not only clear and scientifically vital, very important, but also effective in the end. Because in the end, we will be judged on the basis of specific results we have obtained. Words are not enough, obviously. There has to be something specific. Now, what we have done in Europe quite a bit is emphasize the threats, like erosion, organic matter decline, compaction, salinization. And I want to make it really a point that I have great respect for a group of soil scientists led by Bloom in Vienna. They have pushed on this for years. It has been very effective to put soils on the agenda. And there is now a European soil protection strategy officially accepted by the European Commission in September 2006. It's there on the books, and we have probably a legally binding guideline for soils within a year or so. So that's very good. But now the question is, I think, do we really want to focus on threats in shaping what we are going to do in our profession? I don't think so. First of all, the threat is negative. And I don't think it's a very good idea to hang your wagon onto something negative. But that's a little bit of a side view. It's much more important, I think, to realize that threats relate to issues associated with sustainable development, involving many researchers and disciplines and stakeholders. And we will be a member of a team. And my proposal will be to first focus on the soil functions. I will talk about that in a moment when studying threats. Then take part in the general discussions on the threats right away. I guess that's my point. When you do that, focusing on the soil functions, you can define unique niches for soils and later specific input into the discussions of the team, because we have to talk about threats. Now, another thing about threats that is interesting, that they are a function of time a little bit. This bulletin on the soil protection strategy was written in 2005, and nothing is said about climate change. Very interesting, you know, it comes up now. So threats come and go. Functions stay the same. And, of course, when you're partner of a team, and to be effective as a soil scientist on these issues, you will be part of a larger team. You cannot do that on your own. You're only interesting as a partner, not when you have nice blue eyes or brown eyes or whatever, but when you have something special to offer that is also clear to those with whom you cooperate. And people are very sharp in their judgments there. Now, it's time now to mention the seven soil functions. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying you should adopt the functions that have been adopted in Europe. It's the point of you may define different ones. And I can think of two additional ones, for example. It's the idea. What makes the soil tick? What function does it do in terms of providing ecosystem services? That's the question. Production of food and biomass, storing, filtering, transformation, habitat gene pool, physical cultural environment, source of raw materials, carbon pool, archive of geological and archaeological heritage. very interesting. This covers economic aspects, social aspects very much. Look at number four, look at number seven, and environmental aspects. Okay. So it's a good way of an entry point into sustainability discussions. And of course, functions 1, 2, 3, and 6 are very much interrelated and require an integrated physical, chemical, biological systems approach. And all of them represent ecosystem services. And there have been several papers, as probably you know, where people have tried to estimate the value of all these ecosystem services, and you come to tremendous amounts of $20 or $30 trillion, very rightly so, but somehow it doesn't seem to impress policymakers to the extent that they say, we got to fund these things more than that, so we have to be a bit more specific, I think. Now, of course, some services, food production, raw materials, are directly connected to markets, but most are not. What about services that everybody considers important? Mother love apple pie sometimes, but that nobody wants to pay for, let alone pay for research on these services. Now, there is a task there, that's all that I can say, for the research community to communicate the importance of such functions to a sustainable society. We've got to make an additional effort to put these things on the map. And I'm extremely happy to see that things like the cultural environment, the things like archaeological archive and those kind of things are now acknowledged in the policy arena as official functions that have to be, that are important for society. That's a good thing, but it's up to us to deliver, I think. Now, quickly, how do the soft functions fit into the big societal issues for the next decade? I had 6 of them. I just did a little exercise, and I'm not going to go through that. The conclusion is that these functions, these 7 functions I've mentioned, fit in there beautifully and essentially. Yeah? They fit there in there essentially. And so the niches I was talking about are defined. Now, we have to figure out how we do that, the way we do it, what we do, and how we do it. But this is a very good basis, I think, on the basis of which you can continue this discussion. And let's also realize that we're not the only game in town. Paul Birch has, in one of the CSI news half a year ago or so, had an interesting piece on that, I thought. When you look at the energy crisis and the food security crisis, there are a lot of people in genetic engineering with GMOs who say, no, okay, no problem, we devise crops that are drought-resistant, salt-resistant, and all the rest of it, as if that's a cure for all ills. No, you still have to know the environment in which it has to grow, but they will not often see that. Eh? So, but they're competitive and they get a lot of money. The food security crisis is very interesting because there are some economists who say, food crisis, the crisis is not food, we have enough food. It's marketing, it's the ability of people to pay for it. That's the problem, okay? So it's good to be aware of those kind of discussions when you try to sell your own story. The climate crisis, well, there's a big push for geologic carbon sequestration. Billions of euros and dollars go into that. There were interesting papers this morning, Danny Hillel and Dr. Lal, about possibilities to store more carbon in soils, being a lot more practical, with a lot more very attractive spin-offs for agriculture and society at large than rather in a rather sterile way, putting it under the ground, not knowing exactly what will happen there. But they get a lot of money and a lot of attention. Environmental crisis, there are still a lot of end-of-pipe technological fixes. Whereas we all know water quality, surface water quality, groundwater quality, if you can change your management practices with precision agriculture and all the rest of it, you don't have to clean it up afterwards. So there are lots of opportunities there too. And that is also true for the biodiversity crisis. And the water crisis, well, I've seen a lot of hydrological models where the soil is just kind of a little resistance or something like that, where the potential of soil and land to purify, function 2, is inadequately expressed. Now, I'm not blaming those people that they go for their own business. We do exactly the same. But it shows, I think, quite clearly, which we know already, that we have to make a point strongly, but then specifically, not in general, quite specifically. And this offers a way, an entry point, I think, this crisis analysis to define that. Now, what I would like to do now is run quickly through these functions to make a few specific remarks about that. Arbitrary, because there's much more to say about it, but I think it's important if we say it would be good to focus our research a bit on the functions to see where we are very broadly. When you look at biomass production, well, one has to start with mentioning remote sensing. We can look at the soil, you know, we can see the nitrate status, we can see the moisture status of the crops and everything else. This is just an arbitrary picture of a study I was associated with. Peter Droges made five successive pictures during the growing season of 2003 and could estimate quite reliably, checked in the field also the relative transpiration. Could also do that by soil type and see how different the different soil types reacted and so on and so forth. So it's a very good way of getting yields. This is quite revolutionary to find biomass production along those lines. But then the next question is, of course, why is it high here and low there? And then the information from the soils is often crucial in answer to in order to answer that question. And that answer is very important to come to good management practices. Having said that, the key aspect, of course, of saying biomass production and talking about that as soil scientists is the interaction of roots with the soil. Now, there's a lot to say about that. The problems of the rhizosphere, what happens there? Like Daniel Hillel was saying this morning, this dynamic complex there, all these processes happening, exudates that mobilize nutrients and everything else, there's relatively little we know about it. That's one thing, but another practical thing is that in our structured soils, we find often that the roots are concentrated on the surfaces of the beds. And we've described cases where accessibility of water was more important than availability of water. That's the way we've always looked at it. There are cases where the plants wilt, although you see the available water is still there, but they can't reach it, they can't pull it out quick enough. That happens. And that is when you have the standard homogeneous model of flow, you don't catch those kind of things, of course. And another thing is, of course, the uneven distribution of water in the soil. Process we've described, and others have described, bypass flow is flow of free water along air-filled micropores in the soil. This is a picture from a cracked clay soil in Holland. It's quite old already. Where you found it was just a regular shower, the water was infiltrating along bands along the faces of the prism in just about 10 minutes to a depth deeper than 80 centimeters, taking some of the fertilizer along. But the roots were there also. So then that creates a totally different picture of the way roots interact with the soil. That's all I'm saying. And if you have an implicit assumption in a model that you implicitly assume that the contact between soil and roots is perfect, which is often the case, implicit, eh? Then, well, you're in for making some errors. I was very happy to see with modern techniques in that book on the frontiers that now this is confirmed with magnetic resonance techniques where you can really follow the biological activity in the soil. Now, simulation models are important to characterize these processes of soil versus plants, eh? Through the root contact. Current conditions, but particularly, and that's of course most interesting, what will happen with climate change when the situation changes? We want to be able to predict what will happen in different soils in order to take measures, maybe to focus those measures on certain areas and neglect other areas because there's no money to do everything everywhere, things like that. So models are crucial. But the implicit assumption of many models that soil are homogeneous and isotropic leads to overly simple, I have this K qualification I get on later in my talk, overly simpler representations of soils that we sometimes still find that are not really adequate to do that in the right way. There are the DSAT models, the Decision Support System for Agrotechnology Transfer. It's an enormously successful program applied all over the world. I was involved with it in the early phases. And it has a very delicate system to describe plant growth and plant development and everything else. But the most recent version I've seen is that the soil model is still a tipping bucket model. It's taking available water, third bar, 15 bar. And we all know that can very easily be calculated by regression of texture, organic matter, and bulk density and things like that. So that's very easy. That's not representing reality, but it happens. And anyone can apply that kind of stuff, you know. A little handy student can just do that, and that's it. You don't need soil scientists anymore. So we have to we should not complain about that some of the plant models don't contain the right soil module, but we should do something about it and demonstrate very specifically that it gives erroneous results. We're not used to that. We always want to show successes, but we should also show what does not work. I think that's an important point. And in order to do that, it requires basic research and fieldwork and innovative monitoring technique. There is a new array of new techniques, very exciting, I think, sensors, modern sensors, traces, computer-aided tomography, spectroscopy, etc. Fantastic array of methods to really get a little bit better handle on what makes the system tick, this intricate system that Daniel Hillel was describing so well again this morning, this living thing, which provides such important things. And what we often see now, in certainly in my country, is that there is no money for equipment. There is no money for field work. There is no money to send students out on field trips and everything else. So everybody concentrates on the computer. They can do a lot on the computer, but I think the credit crisis has learned us that this can slightly get out of hand as well, right? Anyway, that's another story, I guess. Function two, storing, filtering, transformation. Again, there's an easy entry point, just like the biomass. The easy entry point is available water. That's it, right? No scientists needed. No soil scientists needed. Also here, CEC, organic matter percentage, and everything else. Now, one thing that is extremely important when storing, filtering, and transformation is to relate that to the flow regime. This is all the work from the good old days in Wisconsin, where Daniel was also there at the time, where we did joint work with the people in virology, and they made a deadly cocktail with a lot of poliovirus, very high concentration. We had a sand column of 60 centimeters, and percolated that at two flow rates, 50 centimeters a day, 5 centimeters a day. It turned out that with 50 centimeters a day, a lot of the virus came out. With 5 centimeters a day, nothing ever came out, and the column was dissected in the end, and there was not a single virus to be found. Of course, we know that's the flow rate. If you have lower flux, the larger pores are filled with air, slower movements through the finer pores, there's more filtration. So these storing, these filtering and transformation forms are directly influenced by the flow regime. And the flow regime is characteristically different for every different soil. Okay, so there's a large area of work that is still to be explored, as I see it. This is an experiment that was done with the bacteriologist, Ms. McCoy. This was a pedal horizon and a B2 horizon, a silt loam B2 horizon with prisms, so with continuous micropores. And this is also an interesting cocktail with fecal streptococcus, fecal coliform, and Pseudomonas aeruginosa. That's a really deadly cocktail here. When you put it on, and this was a very long duration experiment. This took 7 months. Whoops. So I got that back. Yeah, it took about 7 months. When you had a rate of 10 millimeters a day, it came through. It went beyond the structural element, and it came through at pretty high concentrations. Then it was reduced to 3 millimeters a day. It took a while for this one, but ultimately, the cleaning was complete. So there was slower movement, obviously, and it moved more through the micropores, and there was effective adsorption and also die-off and everything else. But the interesting thing was when we erased it again to 10, whoops, it went up again, and we did it again. So you almost could play with that soil. And I find it very interesting. This was a structured soil, and I'm convinced we have not continued this work, that every structure type, and we have all these descriptions in our databases, you know, weak, fine, subangular, blocky, and all the rest of it. They can be characterized, each one of them, with a characteristic flow regime, with points where the bugs come through, the purification is not enough, critical fluxes where this happens and things like that. That would be a very good way to characterize our structures, better certainly than bulk density and the things we use right now. All right. Function three, providing habitat and gene pool. One thing is clear, the properties of the habitat are determined by the water, nutrient, and energy regimes that are partly governed by processes of functions one and two. And because of time, I will not go into that too much, otherwise we will never end here. The gene pool is kind of a new topic of study with fascinating perspectives. And we hear quite a bit about it this week. Soil-borne antibiotics treat human infections. I took from the abstract of Ian Pepper, who we'll talk tomorrow morning, I took the fact that apparently 60% of new cancer drugs, this is a little longer ago, were derived from natural products isolated from soil. That's not my field, but what I hear from specialists on that is very exciting. They say this organic matter was in there for thousands of years, millions of years sometimes, and this is Darwin to the 10th power, what has happened there. So whatever is in there now is extremely powerful, and I find that a very exciting idea, and that could be a major area of activity for the future, I'm sure. Now we have number four, physical and cultural environment. I just give you an example of what we call national landscape in the Netherlands. We have 21 national landscapes. These are landscapes with characteristic soils that we have said we want to preserve it. We don't want it to be built over and everything else because it's very much part of our cultural heritage. It's the social dimension of sustainable development, all right? Now, it's beautiful, isn't it? And that applies more at the regional scale. Function six, carbon pool. I hesitate to raise it in this audience of great specialists, but I quoted, I don't know whether the number is still right, but reading some of the work of Dr. Lal, but also Dr. Hillel and others, there is a large potential for soils to sequester carbon. I guess that's clear. And maybe it is a bit ignored when there's too much attention for other aspects. And I would fully agree with what Dr. Lal said this morning in his presentation, that we should, in a more effective way, show what this could mean in terms of numbers. And I liked very much Dr. Hillel's approach, where he also talks about different soil types, because different soil types have a different story, have different potentials. And I think there's a lot of room there. There's a lot of talk about biochar right now. We used to call that charcoal, but it is now called biochar. These Indian soils in Brazil. Exciting area of research. Now, I just wanted to throw in one example of some of the things we've done in Holland, of trying to diversify our soil type characterization a little bit. Somehow the soil types or the soil series are a little dusty in the sense that, you know, it's there and this is the way it's formed. It's all very interesting. But these are also living bodies. And those lives of different soil series is characteristically different. So we have this fluviquant. That's the prime agricultural soils in the soil in the Netherlands. And we compared three, the same soil type, huh? Three different management, high-tech arable land, organic farming, and permanent meadow. You see characteristically different bulk densities. This is the surface soil. They're significantly different, and also quite different organic matter contents. It's an example of the kind of things the talk was about this morning, that you can use your management, and this is only three, there could be more. We've gone to this thing that we say there are genoforms, these are the soil series, and then we have phenoforms, that form as a function of certain types of management. And we could use these data to get a rather simple regression of predicting the organic matter content as a function of past land use, which is helpful. It's an alternative to the century model. Now, what I want to quickly show is that functions 1, 2, 3, and 6, it has been said already, these physical, chemical, biological processes, that they occur in niches in the soil. Young, from Scotland, had a very interesting presentation in this conference on the future of soil science, future research, I showed you, where he did, with modern scanning techniques, said is less than 0.01% of the soil surface area, there are biofilms that really cause these physical, chemical, biological transformations. And this is all the work looking in a horizontal cross-section of a clay soil that is percolated under saturated condition. There's a horizontal cut. And flow patterns are traced with dye. You see some pores are filled, but others not. Part of them are. This is not, because it is not vertically continuous, because it flows this way. So pore continuity is extremely important, also, of course, for aeration and all the rest of it. And with point counts, we got to volumes of those stained pores that are in line with what is now found with these new techniques. So things happen in tiny spots. And that's another way of looking at our soils, which I find rather fascinating. Now, function seven, for the sake of completeness, another landscape. The difference with the geological and archaeological heritage is that you want to preserve, period. The natural landscapes we had before, we say development and preservation, because you cannot tell people they can't do anything anymore. And that's a very interesting area for landscape architects and so on to try to develop, but at the same time, maintain the essential characteristics of these old landscapes. That's why the distinction between 4 and 7 is meaningful. Now, the 7 functions in context of the problems. I would like to say a few things about how we do it. And I would like to start with how we do it vis-a-vis the external world, so the stakeholders and the policymakers. Having said that, I have finally, and then I wrap it up, some comments at what this means internally for our shops, for our own work. Now, first a general thing, a focus on defining documented options for land use in a given area, and we're always, almost always in a sustainability debate, focused with the question, focused on the question, what do we do with the land? What do we do now? What are we going to do? A lot of options. And sustainable development, there's not one solution that is the right one. You know, there are many roads that lead to Rome, as they sometimes say. And you might all, following these roads, you might all wind up in Rome, ultimately. So go to options, and this is nothing new. I mean, it's part of the scenario approach, of course, including risks and costs rather than judgment on suitabilities or limitations. We have a history in soil survey of defining limitations or suitabilities. You've got this soil, and it has limitations for that. If it's serious, you shouldn't do it. If it is slight, you can do it. And that has had a good function, don't get me wrong. But the time for that is over. Society doesn't go to a scientist to be told what to do, because they also have their own ideas, some of them good, some of them not good. And so if we include options and we present them to the decision makers, then they can take the pick. And the very interesting thing of sustainable development is that these options have environmental, social, and economic consequences. And if you make that visible, the whole debate becomes much more transparent rather than if people just throw out ideas. I get back to that in a moment. There's this diagram that we had a report from the Dutch Academy of Sciences on land use and science and all that, which I want to show because I think it can summarize a little bit what we're trying to do. When we talk about land use, it's good to talk about the DPSAR system. I think most of you are familiar with that. It distinguishes drivers of land use change, pressures that result from that, the impact it has, the response it gets, and the state is the condition of the soil. And the state, and that's an important point, is defined by the 7 soil factors. So if we say we have an area, what is the condition of the land? We say now the 7 functions, how about the production and how the filtering, etc., etc. Okay, that's one way of defining it. And it's grounded then in Europe in the European law, which helps. Okay? Go back to the scheme. In the past, we had the conditions, whatever they were. Then there were drivers and pressures resulting in impacts and responses, so we got the present situation of the soil. This can be a single soil, this can be a field, a farm, a region, a country, whatever, right? It's different skills. Now, for the future, we're not going to say, what is the problem, folks, and we're going to solve the problems, and this is what you're going to do. That's not the way it works. You can say, okay, there are options. Anything is possible. That's a very important point. Even the most crazy idea is fine. It should be ethical. That's one boundary condition, okay? We don't do unethical things. But anything is possible because the crazy ideas of today may be the major innovations of tomorrow. So we have to be very, very careful there if we don't squeeze them out. Besides, if you squeeze out people very early and say, this is ridiculous what you're saying, they may haunt you ever after with their ideas. Just a practical point here. So we get lots of scenarios. And every scenario leads to a future. This is nothing new. Scenario analysis have been made for 20 years or more, I know, okay? Now, the thing that we do, though, is we should do in those larger groups is to say, anything is good, fine, okay, but these are the economic consequences, these are the social consequences, and these are the environmental consequences. And what we've seen, of course, is that sometimes environmentalists look very strongly at the environment, but not so much at the economy and the social things. Economists, I should have started with that, don't look sometimes too much to the environment and to the social consequences, etc. So we say, okay, everything's possible, but we're going to tell you what it is. What are the trade-offs? You can't have your cake and eat it too, right? So that's the point here. So, and when we get the cost-benefit analysis, and we figured we put the economy not in the beginning, as we always do, but put it in the end, right? And then it is offered to the decision makers. Now, I know, of course, I'm not naive, that this is a simplified scheme. And real life is sometimes more complicated. But it's good to have a certain compass to move, and we feel this is a good one. And the choices are made in the policy arena. We don't make the choices. Huh? Some scientists have difficulty with that. If they implicitly assume that they make the decisions and say what is right and what is not, but that's not the way it works. Now, what you read a lot in strategic papers, in project proposals, is you should consult with the stakeholders. You should consult with the policymakers, okay? And it often involves asking people, what do you want? What's your feeling and everything else? That's not, in my experience, that's not enough. So I think you have to be practical about this. Maybe there's a touch of cynicism even in here, but so be it. The really underlying question of everybody is, what's in it for me, okay? And if you send a questionnaire, you may get all kinds of nice answers, but you really have to talk with the people, and often over a drink, to find out what they really think or what they really feel, and translate these questions into options, into scenarios. That's really what you have to do, and anything is possible. So rather than provide specific answers to specific questions, that's mode one, as far as I'm concerned. This is true for stakeholders and policymakers alike. Soil scientists and the other scientists, but soil scientists can have a very important role in there, because if you talk about land, what do we do where and how, then the soil scientists have a very important voice in here. They provide transparency for the broad decision process. And I know that certainly some politicians are not happy with transparency, but so be it. We can provide it and let's see what happens. And that can be focused on sustainable development, and as I said again, there are many roads there. And very important, we also have our own input. So we're not only there saying, what is your question, and how do you feel, and what do you want? No, we also have our own thing. I like this one quote I read of Henry Ford, who said, if I would have listened to my customers, I would have designed a better horse and buggy. And fortunately, he didn't. Eh? So we have a big role in here, okay? But the nice thing of this scheme is that the scientist, in this case the soil scientist, can remain his independence. We have a lot of trouble in our country, and one of the major reasons that scientists are not trusted anymore by society, big statement, but you know, in principle, is that they feel the scientists are part of one of the camps. They're a victim of one of the NGOs who have a very specific purpose with research. Or they sit in the lap of a policymaker, which often happens because they provide the money, okay? And it's very important for scientists to be independent. And the scheme I showed you a moment ago, in principle, in theory, allows that. Because the scientist, the soil scientist, can be important. They can do two things. First of all, assemble all those scenarios, listen to people, translate it into scenarios. Say, okay, fine, everything, never say no. Okay, that's one thing. And then he's involved with the running with his colleagues, showing specifically what all the trade-offs are. Economic, social, and environmental, and presenting that and taking part in that discussion so that a valuable, transparent process occurs. And if it's done right, he is the independent expert. And I think that's very important that we keep striving for that, because if we become victims of those who pay us, we are very much considered of his or her master's voice, and then we are not as effective, and we lose one of the very basic traits of our profession. So, like I say, we should avoid the master's voice, and in this context, expression of options, including a risk and uncertainty analysis. That's very important, is very important. Now, then there's another item, improved communication and public relations. That's also, of course, said a lot. I mentioned two things, maybe somewhat arbitrary. There are good measures for air quality, for water quality, and as yet not for soil quality. And that's really a problem. We've defined, but I'm not saying this is to be done, but we've defined one thing in saying now, let's focus now on, you can have a different quality related to the seven functions. Let's look at the biomass one, the first one. And we've said the ratio we want is the water limited yield as a ratio to the potential yield. The potential yield means it's determined by radiation and by the temperature, the nutrients are okay, the water is okay, there are no pests and diseases. So you get these very high numbers, but it's potentially possible. And the water limited yield is everything is there except you use the actual water regime at the site, okay? You get rate, and multiply by 100, you get a number. You can also have an absolute, this is a characteristic for a site, you can also have an absolute soil quality based on the maximum potential yield on this earth somewhere, and they've told me that is 41 megagrams per hectare per year. Okay. Now, just a quick example. We kind of played around with that a little bit. We had a ferric red tropical soil in Nigeria, one in China, an acrisol. We had a feral soil in Zambia. Potential productions are quite different. This is an equivalent grain, it is called, right? It's not a particular crop. There's a certain calculation going on there. I cannot go in details, but that is being done. The potential yield is different because the climate is different, okay? The radiation is different. Then the land quality on the water limited yield is pretty high, but is characteristically lower here in this one. And the land quality absolute is kind of interesting, 32, 20, 27. And what we also did is calculate the quality after there was erosion. And maybe that's the most interesting one of this thing. That shows that here, that didn't make too much of a difference. If you have a rather deep soil that is fertile, it doesn't make too much of a difference at that point. I'm not talking about downstream, of course. That's a different story. But in this particular case in Zambia, the effect is much stronger, right? Now, that allows you also to get a little bit of a feel what might the possible effects be of certain measures or certain effects on certain soils. Anyway, this is one example. I'm not saying this should be done, but I think we should really look for a soil quality measure that we can communicate to the general public because we don't have it. Now, the second thing is this thing of the ecological footprint you've heard about, and this conference is dedicated to the footprint. And it's a shoe on a boulder in the brook, I saw. I don't know really what that means, but it's the number of hectares indicating the area of land needed for a certain level of consumption and can be estimated for a person, a country, a continent, or for the world as a whole. Now, you know the numbers. For each world citizen, that would be 2.1 hectare, the US 9.4, Europe 4.7, India 0.9. I think it's an interesting concept, but it has been used in a rather strongly ideological manner. We're obviously the bad guys, which I guess we are in some ways, but there are some problems with this. 50 to 60% of that number is determined by energy use. And that is translated into the area you would have to plant with trees in order to create the same amount of energy that the people are using. Now, I'm convinced that in 20, 30 years, we will be able to harness the sun. I think the energy problem is a finite problem. Okay, we will see. But still, planting all those trees, the people that have set this up have not used real field data to check whether that soil is there, and if the land is there, and whether there is a possibility to do that. It has all been done in a rather conceptual, generalized way, and I think we could do a lot better by bringing in our soil science expertise and getting more realistic numbers, and because this is a very powerful image, the ecological footprint. It's a very powerful image, and I think we have detached ourselves a little bit from it. I think we shouldn't. We should jump in and get a more well-founded expression. It's a footprint. It's on the land, right? We saw this slide this morning of this big footprint was on the land. So it is our ball game, and I think we should play it. Now, I'm almost through. Just a few things. This is the what and how. What does it mean maybe for our own profession? And I hope we'll have some more discussion on this when I'm through. It's one of the things I like to talk about is what I call the community of scientific practice. I guess most of you are familiar with the community of practice. It was proposed by Wenger in 98. It's source of scientists of different disciplines working together with stakeholders and policymakers. That's a community of practice. You do things together in line with MOG2. I'm all in favor. But I've seen too many very well-intentioned scientists kind of embark on their own, on trying to work in these broad groups. I talked about this earlier, and getting lost, and getting very disappointed and frustrated and all the rest of it. So I personally feel very strongly that as a scientific community, and even as a soil scientist community, we first have to get our own act together, if you like, before we embark on those communities of practice. So that's why I say let's work on a community of scientific practice that does include applied scientists, fundamental scientists, communication experts, all those kind of people that are very much part of this modern setup that you need. Now, that's as an entry point. I have a few points. First of all, the soil physicists, pedologists, chemists, and biologists should work together on the functions 1, 2, 3, and 6. This time of these things being quite separated, which is still very much the case, I saw this week, I think we have to do that also. But at the same time, really try to work together. And I like this idea of the observatories, where you do take an integrated approach to characterize the processes when they work all together, and communities of, and before working with stakeholders in the community of practice and observatories is a good idea. That's the first thing. And this has been said before, of course. So let's talk about this. What do you think, how we can really do that? I think the observatories is a very good way of really doing it. Now, the second thing is pay more attention to defining risks and uncertainties. If you give a result and it doesn't work out, you're being blamed, right? If you give a result and at the same time you include an assessment of risk, you say, wow, with 80% certainty we can do this, 20% is uncertain, and people recognize that, you create a much better situation because, it was a 20% risk that it wouldn't work. So, we told you so. It seems rather elementary what I'm saying, but with all the statistical techniques we have and the Monte Carlo simulations and what have you, we can rather easily do it, and I don't think we do it enough. I think we should in that way communicate more clearly. Number three is I think we should reestablish the knowledge chains linking tested knowledge and cutting-edge expertise. Now, this is an old Cornell scheme. I like it. Knowledge is being divided up into axes, empirical and mechanistic, you may know it, and qualitative and quantitative. K1 is basically user expertise, tested knowledge, empirical, qualitative. Then you get qualitative and mechanistic, so more understanding of the underlying mechanisms, K2. And here you get various forms of research, empirical, quantitative, regression analysis and those kind of things. And here, K5, you get the really cutting-edge stuff that is quantitative and mechanistic. As it is, a lot of our papers are this. You have to have that because otherwise publication is difficult. I think we have forgotten a little bit that the chain, and this is the chain, of course, I should sketch it in there, is something that is very important. And that's, we've lost that a little bit. I think we should get back to that. When there's a certain problem, start talking with people out there, start talking with the experts, and try to see, there are some problems that can be solved very well with K3 expertise. You don't need a sophisticated model with cutting-edge technology and everything else. Others, you really need it. But what we see now sometimes is a lot of K5 research that it's almost like little pieces of a puzzle, and the puzzle is never made, okay? The pieces fly all over the place. They're very interesting and very smart and everything else, and they give nice papers, but they don't form a puzzle. And I think we cannot afford anymore as a profession to produce too many pieces that are not part of a puzzle. Let's put it that way. Now, there's one thing I was very intrigued with, and Harry Lynn has been very instrumental in that, in getting hydropedology of the floor, so to speak, where pedological expertise, and then I'm talking particularly about the soil survey expertise, the tested knowledge there, combine that with the soil physics stuff in hydropedology, which is one way of getting this knowledge chain established. And I think that's a very good initiative in that regard. Number four. Prepare storylines of your soils. What we heard this morning, soil is a living body. What we do so far is very good. You know, we explain how the soil was formed, geomorphology, history, influence of man and everything else. But we can extend that. I showed you earlier the example of the prime agricultural land in Holland. This is our most common sandy soil in Holland. And we did the same thing, looked at land use, the phenoforms. This is old grassland, bulk density, organic matter. This is reseeded grassland. And this is arable land, highly significant different bulk densities, different organic matter contents. And again, the possibility, I showed it here, to calculate the organic matter content as a function of previous land use. We need storylines, and the people are very receptive to that, I find. So we have to communicate about our soils in a somewhat innovative way. Five, guarding the scientific integrity and quality of our professionals, perhaps by certification. Now, I've made this point already, but I make it again because I think it's crucial. Using accessible databases, Peter transfer functions, user-friendly simulation models, remote sensing and flashy 3D GIS. Anyone who can handle a computer can produce good-looking but not necessarily good soil reports. Let's face it. And in fact, many young graduates start their own consulting firms right now in Holland without having access to research. Now, extended mining of existing data is an absolutely dead-end street for every profession. We know that. But we should really realize that that's the case. Okay? And we should also show that certain questions that are being raised cannot be answered by existing expertise. We do need new types of research that can gap the bridge of knowledge. Okay? We should not take it for granted that people say, oh yeah, of course you do research. No, that's not the way it works now in a knowledge democracy, if you like. And probably errors can hurt us. And if certification is a way of doing it, I don't know. You have experience with that in America, we don't. And number six, I'm almost at the end, initiate and support basic research. That's basically the same point I said a moment ago. We still know very little about the most complex ecosystem of the world, the soil. Continued basic soil research that fits in the knowledge chain K1 to K5. That would be my only point. So if you do basic research, it is very nice if it fits in the chain, okay? It's essential to remain a viable and thriving scientific discipline that is recognized by its peers. And that's the only way you stay in those groups. When you're recognized by your peers as being scientific, just have good scientific quality. And as we are a relatively small group, scattering of research activity is a real danger. So that's why I suggest we provide a major thrust of our research on the soil functions. It doesn't mean you can't do anything else, but I think that would help to really focus our effort and become more effective. So what's the frontier? Because the talk was all about this. To become more effective towards the outside world, represented by various stakeholders, policymakers, and the public at large by, at the right time in the right place, very important, contributing crucial soil input to sustainability studies by realizing that you can only be a serious partner in a transdisciplinary team studying sustainable development when you have unique contributions to make. Define your niche. And some suggestions were given, but I hope others will come up in the discussion. By not primarily focusing on soil threats, which are very broad, including socioeconomics, but first on soil functions, our tools. These are our tools. Taking the results to the larger group studying threats. Threats that we see now, but also threats to the future. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we can now define the threats that will be hot in 2020? That's the real challenge, isn't it? By getting our soil science act together, current atomization of subdisciplines and the separation of field lab and computer is detrimental, in my view. Suggesting re-establish the knowledge chain and work jointly on the functions, and maybe, again, those observatories might work there. I don't know. By considering the concept of a community of scientific practice for soil science with a complete knowledge chain, K1 to K5, and specialists in communication and interaction. Science, including soil science, has to recover its societal license to research. I'm not quite sure whether it's that bad for soil science. Now I read that. But anyway, there's a threat, right? By pursuing basic research that is connected to the research chain. Without it, mining of existing data only will mean the untimely end of the profession. It's that clear. An array of new techniques, and I listed a whole bunch of them, I'm not going to read them out for you, is ready to be applied. Very exciting. And is needed to open new frontiers. Protecting our independence as a researcher by not being his master's voice of finances, stakeholder groups, NGO or policymakers, go for options and create transparency for decision making. And building on the fascination with soils of the public at large by communicating just examples, soil quality concepts and the footprint concepts, as well as storylines for major soil types. We can do more on that one. And finally, let's be modest. We still understand little about the most complex ecosystem of the world, the soil. All we can do is create conditions that we hope will allow the soil to live up to its potential. But let's not forget that the soil is in charge. All we can do is observe, measure, model, facilitate, and hope, and perhaps pray, some of you, for the best, right? Thank you.
Well, we have quite a bit of time for questions, so I certainly encourage you to follow up the very stimulating, thought-provoking lecture that Dr. Bauma gave. And so I think everybody is welcome to ask questions. Let me turn the light on so we can... Yes, Nick.
Okay, no, I'm glad you asked the question because I should explain a bit more clearly. Is there a microphone in the house, by the way, for people to talk into?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe not.
It's maybe handy because people may not.
Yeah, just be louder.
I could hear him, but for the rest of the discussion.
Maybe you can repeat the question if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Just briefly.
Well, that was the diagram with the K1 to K5. Eh? I said at the same time data mining is a little bit dangerous. What I meant, putting the piece together is often done. That's quite right. What I'm saying is, I guess, trying to say is that if you take the existing databases and use that, that is, in the end, you're going to be dry because the questions will evolve and you need new research in order to be able to adequately answer those questions. That's basically the point. And if you don't do that, and research is under a certain amount of pressure. And let me say, one question in the couple of years I had the fascinating pleasure to walk around in the Hague or government center. One question I've heard an awful lot from politicians is, you guys in research, you've been going on for 100 years, 150 years. Well, you know already quite a bit. Well, why don't you apply that? And I can understand that because quite a few of our research proposals, and I think as researchers we're almost forced to do that. I say that at the same time. When you read it, you have almost the impression that you have to start from scratch, right? And I hardly ever read the proposals now. Listen, we have worked on this for 100 years, and this has been done, and this has been done. And now, in order to really address that question that is urgent now, this is really a piece of knowledge that we really lack. And if we have it, this is what we can do. This kind of proposal, we don't have it, because the page limits are too strong, right? It doesn't fit in the page limits, and that's why we don't write it down. So that leads to the reaction, you guys, you know, why are you guys... And that's why I also said there are some problems that can be solved with K3 knowledge. Fine, solve it with K3 knowledge, you know. But others cannot. And we have to make more specific, I think, that, and I'm so convinced that we need these new techniques. We've got to make more a case for it, to show that if we don't do that, we give run-of-the-mill reports and advices that aren't any good, that aren't going to serve the purpose. We have to do a better job as far as that goes, I think. But there's an enormous potential. If you go to these meetings, you show all this enormous potential. It's just putting things together. Get our act together a little bit. That's, I guess, my key point. Sorry.
More questions? I hope you would like to take this opportunity to have some interesting discussions. Yes, please.
Yeah, interesting talk. Thank you. Coming back to just what you were talking about, the questions that we get, well, you know, you've been doing research for so long, you know, well, why don't you just apply it? But yet you come up with statements, you know, nothing about soils. You know, I kind of have trouble with those sentences because we know so much.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there are large issues that are relevant today that we have to put our knowledge in the concept of today's problem. So how can you reconcile with statements that we know very little about a complex system versus the 100 years that we've been studying?
Yeah. Now, glad for that question as well. That statement, or we know very little about it, is a bit of a... finishing statement, so to speak. See, it's all relative. See, if you, and I was reinforced this morning listening to Dan's paper, but of course we've seen this also in other places. It's enormously complex. So if this is the amount of uncertainty, we know maybe this much, but this is already quite a bit, and you can do quite a bit with it. Eh? So if I say we know little about it, we know enough about it to be able to do a very good job in many instances and in many cases. I guess that would be a better phrase. But we still, I think, should know more in order to do a better job. But that is a very bland statement. I think that should be accompanied, and I repeat myself now, I guess, with that thing of making that clear why that is so. So that you show what you can do with what you know, and it's a lot already. Yeah? In the absolute sense, the enormous complexity of the soil ecosystem, it is maybe, in an absolute sense, it's little, but in a relative sense, it's quite a bit, and I follow you there completely, that's absolutely right, but it's not enough to, on the basis of that, face those six challenges for the next 50 years to come. I guess that's what I'm saying. Does that help?
Yeah, it does. Saying that we just need more information, we need more dollars,
right.
But I think it behooves us to say that the dollars that have already been invested have been well spent, and here's what we're going to do with the next investment.
No, I think we don't do a very, very good job on that. They don't make it very easy for us either, for the reasons you indicate. It has to be simple. When we look at the European Union, those proposals, they're all pre-formatted, and you have one page for this and one and a half page for that and all that, so it's not made easy. So we have to also find new ways, I think, of communicating what we know. And I've seen, well, one of the ideas, the concept of these scenarios, show and tell, is that visualizing things can also help a lot. So you can do a lot of things, underlying things, that result in, let's say, maps, saying, now this is the current land use, and this is what it could be, and these are the management systems that go with it, and everything else, with a whole lot of underlying information. If they want that, they can get it, but you don't put it up front, because I fully agree with you, that turns people off if you have too much of that. There's one thing you want to avoid, of course, as we all realize, and a lot of funding agencies, but particularly politicians, are allergic for that, is to say, give me more money, and without really explaining what you're going to do. This old concept of the scientist sitting on his pole and in his great wisdom do things, and if something comes out, sometimes it may even take 30 years to be successful, this type of stories. That people are very allergic for that, and I think rightly so. But getting back to your main point, I fully agree. I think we have to find new ways of communicating things and communicating things. And what I said, maybe a touch cynical, I don't believe in this business, ask people, what do you ask us? What are your questions? I don't find also to politicians, what are your questions? Sometimes they don't have the faintest idea, certainly politicians. And it doesn't help to blame them for that. So you really want to find out what's the underlying consequence. And for politicians, it often is they want to leave something behind. And time is short. They may be out of a job the next year, you know. So, well, that's the way it is. So find out what makes their system tick. And some people think that's very opportunistic. Well, I think it's taking using the opportunities that are there. That's the way I would phrase it. So what's in it for me is a very good way to go about it, and then use modern means of maps and illustrations to make the point, I would say. But there's still a lot to learn. But I think maybe another point that is very important for me is that these kind of things, I think it's very important for, well, let's put it that way. I was in a big workshop a couple of weeks ago, and then some people said rather desperately, well, you know, you want us scientists to do all these things. It's impossible. We already don't have time enough as it is right now, okay? So that's why I talk about this community of practice with the knowledge chain. You have people in applied research. You have people in basic research. You have communication specialists. And divide your tasks. Be a team, so you know from one another what you're doing. Divide your tasks and operate as a team. You cannot do that anymore as an individual. And that's extremely important. And the way the financing structures are squeezing now the scientific community into a number of little islands where people just struggle for survival. It's a bit dramatic, but that's basically what it boils down to. It's not good at all. It's very unwise, I think, what's happening. And we can complain about it, but maybe we can also generate from our own spheres some activities that can overcome that, because it's not a good trend.
Actually, if I could, I'd like to add a perspective on this question. I think in a spirit of discussions, I thought this is also something important for the community to think about. Yeah, we have over 100 years of knowledge about soils, but I think there are two important pieces to make a better pitch for our community and beyond is that the classical way of doing science is truncated into pieces. Smaller chunks and smaller chunks. We forget to put the pieces back to the overall who. So we do know a lot of pieces, but I don't think we know enough about the whole system as a holistic view. And that's two dimensions. One dimension is within the soil system itself. Yeah. How does physical, chemical, biological process interact at different times and different spatial scales? I don't think we know that well. We know pieces a lot. Yes, but we have not yet put them all together and understand back in the natural system how they function. I think that one is still unanswered, and that's one reason we need more money to do that kind of research. And then the second dimension is beyond our soil system, how the soil interacts with atmosphere, hydrology, vegetation, in that kind of integrated, holistic view of the natural system. None of us in all disciplines have really handle that well, and that's another reason that we're tied to bigger picture, bigger funding opportunities. So I think that's the way I would view. Yeah, we know a lot, but we really don't know. We had to be modest in a way that we, be honest, that we do not know the complexity of nature that well yet. And I think that's probably the reason that Johan was also trying to refer to. We know a lot, but yet we feel we do not know a lot. So, well, follow up comments or other questions, please.
Johan, I'm assuming that in your time in The Hague, you had an opportunity to look at a whole range of scientific endeavors, not just soil science, so, and see how other people were doing it. Now, in your talk, you brought in some generic ways of going about achieving what you've made a very good case that we need to achieve. But looking at other scientific endeavors, are there any
Well, for Holland, I think the medical science would be providing some examples where they because there's sometimes a bit negative talk about the medical science in terms of the big firms dominating, etc., etc. I've seen some good cases where they have in a proactive way reacted to certain problems and had very good communication activities, got political support and everything else, and got tremendous funding out of it. Of course, it's very close to the skin of people, huh? Their health. So you're in a somewhat different ballgame if you talk about the land. I think there was a reference this morning. I don't know whether you did it, Dan, or somebody else who was talking about, was saying, if you treat on the land, you don't hear anything. It doesn't say, ow, get out, or something. And I thought it was nice. Of course, that's right. So that's a bit of work. There are cases. The medical case is one. In terms of the earth sciences, I can only talk about Holland. There's a lot of complaining that that is not enough attention to things, and I find that not very helpful, let's put it that way. So we have now a committee from the Royal Academy of Sciences looking at the earth sciences in 2020, and we try to get that message across. And one of the real hot issues, almost literally, is the heat exchange. Now they make auger holes to 40, 50 meters, and they pump it down in the summer and pump it up in the winter. Very interesting from an energy point of view, but some of the sedimentologists say, no, we don't know what we're doing. We're puncturing all kind of layers, and what does it mean for our water regimes, for our groundwater quality and everything else? And that is then an issue that really registers with the policymakers. It's close to the skin, let's put it that way. Okay, so without going into too many other examples, there are examples, yes, and I think we can learn from them, but we have the particular characteristics of our own profession to deal with, right?
Yes, please.
I wonder if our field has a particular challenge to it. You know, an aerospace engineer, they have the opportunity to say, well, I can build an airplane that goes 6,000 miles an hour. Or a chemist can say, I can develop this molecule that will do this amazing thing. Yep. Whereas we deal with a system that our experience is, we know that it is full of constraints. Certainly there are opportunities. By taking care of our system, we can improve our water quality. But oftentimes, at least my experience and my knowledge, as limited as it is about soil, is that soil is not some revolutionary kind of material where there has no limit in terms of what it's possible for it to do. But it has certain constraints in terms of what it can do. And that challenges our ability to perhaps to and it also means that there are, I guess with other disciplines, there are certain externalities that might never be felt by the public if certain innovations are made. Whereas with the soil-related there are no externalities. Because if you want better water quality, well, then it means that landscape will be constrained in some way.
Yep.
And we'll get better water quality, of course, but there are constraints. And so I wonder about that, mm-hmm. how that constrains us as scientists and constrains our ability to be as effective
right.
as we can.
Right. Can understand your concern. We have in soil science not the equivalent of the putting a man on the moon within 10 years, this type of thing. But, it's particularly a matter, I think, the question in as much as it discourages you to do the kind of things we've been talking about. I think if you are in for instant success and glory, I don't think soil science is the first thing you would choose, if that's what you're after. I'm not talking about you, I'm talking in general, right? But, wow, my goodness, if you look at the world at large, you're able to stand back and look at the whole thing. And again, this morning, wonderful presentations. The challenge there is fantastic, and you get the personal satisfaction of contributing to that. I can hardly think of anything that would be more gratifying than that, potentially, quite frankly. And if there are people that don't understand it, it's their problem, eh? Well, I mean, I'm not going to accept all the problems. So it's a bit of an individualistic type of thing, being a soil scientist, I guess. You have to see that and go for it and not look for the short-term successes and glory and everything else, but you're really working on essential things. Dan Hillel mentioned this morning again that the name of Adam in the Bible is soil. Huh? No, these are the kinds of things we talk about. I'm serious about that. I think that's very important. So it's a personal consideration you have to make. And I can see what you think. It's less spectacular than many other things, but it's bloody important.
Well, but that's the spectacularity of it isn't where my question comes.
Okay.
From. But I think, for example, where I work on the eastern shore of Maryland, poultry manure has been applied for decades. And I've been studying drainage widths and how well the soils that develop in them can absorb phosphorus. And there's so much nutrient management work that's done about that.
Yeah.
Whereas it seems like the basic solution to the problem is simply to grow less chickens in that landscape.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, there are so many jobs that are associated with remedying against all of this manure. And it seems like we're grateful to have jobs like that.
Yeah.
But really, we have our hole in a bucket. We have our finger in a hole in a bucket that has many holes.
Yep.
And we're not necessarily solving a problem by being a soil scientist in that.
No, I'm glad with your example. I'm glad with your example. I recognize I work on manure in Holland, which is comparable. I dare say it's even more complicated probably than the chickens in Maryland, but I don't know. The diagram there can work, I think, in the sense that, you step back and say, now this is the situation now, and it is rather fixed because there are all these interests. Eh? That's mode two. All these people are and have different interests and everything else. But there are certain action groups, I'm sure, that say it should be done differently. So then I think the scientists, and particularly the soil scientists, because it's a matter of what are we going to do where it has a spatial component, eh? Can say, okay, what are the alternatives? And you can have land use scenarios that create as much employment, maybe, than this, in a different way. So you can really use your knowledge and your system translating to spatial patterns in different scenarios. Not say, this is, has to be done, the chickens have to go, which is, it doesn't work. Of course it doesn't work, right? Sure. And that so it creates a certain, I've seen examples of that. It creates a certain amount of transparency that acts as a lubricating agent for the discussions. It brings people to say, hey, that's interesting, I never thought of that. There is now, in Holland, there are experiments, very, very difficult, on industrial ecology, where we have all these chicken barns there and everything else. They put them together, with the pigs and the cattle, and then they have a little energy factory, and they close all the cycles. It's cradle to cradle. Fantastic example. It's difficult to do, but it's one option to do it. And then it's a matter. But that, so that's the current scenario. There are these kind of scenarios that you can follow. You can have an extra park, and that make an overall plan more attractive because it's more function 4 or function 7. So show and tell, huh? And let others decide. So you can so the procedure. That's why I'm glad with your question. Can help to loosen up things. To make things more transparent, but to also lubricate the process. And that's a big challenge.
I have many questions, too many to ask at the present time, but I do have a short story to tell. Back in the year 19 or 18? Brady is a man I met in 1964, just a few years earlier, on the first visit of the International Soil Science Congress in the Soviet Union. He was then serving not only as professor, but
you so much for your kind words. I do want to, like you, so you raise your hand, you have a question. Why don't you go ahead before?
Johan, I was prompted to ask a question about research funding when you indicated that the politicians were only interested in their legacy. Their first interest is to get reelected, and perhaps they'll develop a legacy. More often than not, they don't.
Okay.
But research funding, I think, is a very serious issue in the United States right now. Our federal government, and especially our state governments, are really in trouble. And I don't know where that kind of funding that you need for the work you're talking about is going to come from. Maybe you're better off in Europe, I don't know. But as a former administrator, I have great concerns about research funding because I fear that it's going to react to emergencies. If you have H1N1 and you need 10 million in research, you'll have it tomorrow. But for the kind of work you're talking about, I think it's going to be very, very difficult.
Okay. Well, I take your comment very seriously, knowing what you've done as a dean in Wisconsin. And while I can only say, sorry to hear it, is it different in Europe? I think it is a bit. I think the European Union, for one, is putting a lot of money in research and FP in their funding programs, large interdisciplinary programs. I was reviewing a program in Germany. They were here earlier, but they're gone now. Helmholtz Foundation. There's a lot of money going in research in Germany, a lot of money, billions of euros. And they still complain not having enough money. That's another side of the coin. But anyway, so I listen to you, and I hope it will not be true in Europe, and certainly I hope it will not turn out so bad in the U.S., but I take your point. It illustrates that the communication and the selling, if you like, in a positive sense, is also very important. But the question of the gentleman behind you is also soil science will never have, at any point in time, the immediate urgency of H1N1. It's another fact. Huh?
So well, we did kind of right after 9/11, like the anthrax threat, kind of related, more or less.
Yeah.
Well, I know the time is running short, and I do have a last official function to wrap up this Brady Distinguished Lecture. Here's the plaque from the society in recognizing Dr. Johan Balmer, and the plaque says the Soil Science Society of America recognizes Johan Balmer as a distinguished scholar presenting the 2009 Niall C. Brady Frontiers of Soil Science lecture, a lectureship funded through the Agronomic Science Foundation, signed by the President of Soil Science Society of America and the President of the Agronomic Science Foundation. So with that, I would like to present this to you.
Thank you.
Johan, for your wonderful.
Thank you.
Okay.